Do we get to talk about Odium?
Yes, Odium, the divided one. Go, Paul. The
divided one. Oh, this is so cool. I wrote in my my live reaction was, oh, well, Tervangian just said he thinks he can do good and save everybody. So we can all kind of pack it up. We don't have to. We were worried about the Contest of Champions, but sounds like we're all good. So we can pack it up. I'm excited and encouraged by him, you know, taking control. He confronts Cultivation a little bit by, like, this was intentional, wasn't it, that you would have me on this fluctuating intelligence and emotion levels where he can sort of sometimes rule over the power of Odium and sometimes feel the power of Odium, which is a really interesting dynamic, and it's really cool, and I really happen to love this. The divided one sentiment is so cool.
Welcome back to Following Noah on Stormlight Podcast. This week is episode 237, and we are in chapters 31, 32, 33, Interlude 3, and Interlude 4. Elliot, how are you?
I'm doing very well. I noticed something this week. You said something to me, and I was like, nah, and now I started noticing it. You were talking to me about the physical copy of the book and how you've noticed it to start to like warp and bow a bit. And that is absolutely happening to my book. And it's bothering me a lot. Like the cardboard, you know, like hardback sides, they cannot handle this amount of pages. I cannot figure out the correct way to set this thing that doesn't cause it to start to bend on itself. This thing is a beast.
I have displayed my wind in truth on its side from this point on after noticing that.
I didn't fully believe you, Trevor, and I went and looked and did the same thing and saw that, okay, my book is standing up and the pages are kind of coming out a little bit. They're too heavy, they pull out, and so it sags, and the pages are on the flat shelf, whereas the binding is still trying to be upright. So I also had to lay them down, which is very devastating because Alex and I are very proud of our bookshelf and how it's organized. And now we have books that are sideways, and that's not what we wanted.
But even if you do flat, I've been trying to do this. I think the weight of the pages pulling on the back of the binding is still like bowing the cover a bit. You see that? I don't know if you can see on my camera here. Like,
do you think we need... Yeah,
slopes down.
Do you think we need to like, man, how do I do this? Do I need to like vacuum seal my bag, my book, and preserve it for eternity or something?
You need to suspend it in zero gravity.
Yeah, exactly. Where it doesn't feel strain on the binding.
I think it may just be down to Brandon convinced the publisher to let him get away with a couple 30,000 extra words, and I think he was wrong and the publisher was right and they shouldn't have done that many pages.
Yep.
Yeah. I didn't think about that. Yeah. I'm going to have to go look and see. Maybe we'll test. Alex and I both have a book. Maybe we'll test the wear and tear upright versus side or whatever.
Do a little science fair project on it.
One is on top of the other, maybe holding it down. Like maybe the top book will bow more than the bottom. No idea. Time will tell.
Paul, how are you?
I'm doing great. I last week I shouted out that I got a new keyboard, and I realized a couple weeks ago, I think three episodes ago, I actually got a new hookup for my mic. I don't know if anyone listening could tell. I personally can tell when I listen back, and I think it makes a big difference, and I'm very happy about it. But I should have shouted that out a while ago, since I'm just shouting out all the things that neat little things I got. This was leftover. I actually got the mic stuff for Christmas. By the time this releases, we're way past Christmas, but you know, very exciting news over here. Very cool. So yeah, doing well.
Wonderful. All right. the end of day two in Wind and Truth, which notably is quite a bit further than 1/5 of the way through the book. I would just like to point that out. Paul, do you have two words to summarize these chapters?
I do. I went really deep and philosophical this week. My two words to describe these chapters are battle Shallan. And that is because Shallan battles. Very deep. Really took me a long time to... there's a lot of implications there, right?
You meditated for hours for that one.
Yes. I really... I feel enlightened, truly. Yeah. I feel truly enlightened. But no, I did choose that intentionally because it is quite unique that we have a lot of this episode and some last episode. Like, we have quite a bit of Shallan fight sequence, like action, which is not typically what we get with Shallan, which is kind of neat. It's kind of a neat little change of pace, and quite exciting. Usually it's like the Kaladin is the action sequence while Shallan is world building, but here it's like the exact opposite this book, which is I'm kind of enjoying it.
Elliot, do you have two words?
I do. I think I might be overselling these chapters a little bit with these two words, but it was the best I could come up with. I went with shattered realities for a couple of reasons. When the perpendicularity breaks down, it definitely feels like this massive event where we're shifting from one reality to the next as our characters get sucked into this other world. And what in the world is it going to be like? Paradigm shift, perhaps, in our story coming up here. But then over in the Zeth storyline as well, I feel like we're starting to chip away a little bit at Zeth, actually. Kaladin's been trying to reach out to him for a while now and with no success. And then all of a sudden, like, a little chink in his armor it appears, and Zeth starts to open up a little bit. So a little bit of like shatteredness there. And then we're still trying to explore Shinnevar. What is the reality of Shinnevar as it is today? Zeth seems very confused and worried. I didn't know what to expect to begin with. So here we go. I think we're about to learn a lot more about Shinnevar here very soon.
And Ishar just poofs in and out at free will.
Hey, he just casually walks up. You know, hey, Callan, yeah. What's up?
Do you want to summarize 31 through I-4?
Yeah, let me hit some of the highlights in case you're listening to this and haven't read the book in a while. So chapters 31 through 33 closes out the end of day two, and then we're also going to cover interludes 3 and 4. Chapter 31, Shallan gathers up a couple of folks to go into Shadesmar to try and catch the Ghostbloods, who are hoping, they think, to hop along with Dalinar Navani into the spiritual realm when they open the perpendicularity. Of course, we find out throughout the course of these chapters that actually Moraes is rather cleverly tagging along with Shallan as her guards, basically pulling the same trick on her that she just pulled on him a couple of chapters ago. And let's see what else do we get here. Wit drops a bomb about, oh, by the way, I was there when humans came from Ashen over to Rashar, and says, oh, by the way, that would be a really good event for you to go check out. And then you can come back and tell me about it, and I can see whether you're seeing the truth or not. And that's kind of what they set up. Only, as I alluded to a second ago, things don't go quite as they planned, in that Mraes throws a wrench in it, or a dagger, a anti-stormlight dagger into it, which collapses the perpendicularity, sucking all of our characters into the spiritual realm and locking them there with no hope of getting back. At least as far as we know, that's obviously the story in front of us, is how are they going to get back through the spiritual realm and the perpendicularities. There's a couple other bits in here which we're going to go through. Lyft makes an appearance along with Gavinor. Lyft does not get sucked into the perpendicularity. Gavinor does. Oh, dear.
Oh, dear.
And then, yeah. And then over in Kaladin and Zeth world, they're just trying to figure out what's going on, making a plan. Kaladin makes some terrible stew, and the wind shows up for a chat. Ishar shows up for a chat. Zeth starts to open up and chat after he tastes the terrible stew. In progress, I think, in that storyline a little bit. Interludes. Interlude 3 is from the perspective of L, and L just waltzes in and kills off Yezrian, who I think was already mostly gone. And Odium says, "Wow, that was cool. How about you come be my general of my army?" And then in interlude 4, over with Odium, he's kind of going on more of the whole divided one thing. Do I do what's right? Do I take over the Cosmere? What do I do with this power that I've got? I'm actually really fascinated by the whole divided one thing. I'm excited to talk about it. So
That's
probably enough summary. Let's get into it.
I need to make one minor side note. I feel like it was so casual how L lost the soul of Yezrian forever. It seemed like he was like, "Oh yes, this gemstone has the soul of the Herald Yezrian." Whoops. There he goes. Yeah. Reminds me, I'm adding to my list of references. In like Kung Fu Panda, whenever he knocks over the soul of the it's like urn of like 1,000 souls or whatever, and it falls over and it's like a whoa, like the like little spirits like disintegrate and make a little noise. It's exactly what I was picturing, but a little more serious in this scene.
I had a very cartoonish vision of the perpendicularity collapsing, actually. The perpendicularity, like, you know, blows up or whatever and like shrinks down. And then Wit and Lift like look at each other and go, like pretend like nothing just happened. Anyway. Okay, we're going to talk about none of that to start. We're going to talk about epigraphs because we have the Way of Kings epigraphs to talk about. So I'm going to go through them real quick. This is the rest of the epigraphs from day 2. Here we go. "I do not have answers, and there will always be some who denounce me for this decision that I made. But let me teach a truth here that is often misunderstood. Sometimes it is not weakness, but strength to stand up and walk away. Those who offer blanket condemnation are fools, for each situation deserves its own consideration, and rarely can you simply apply a saying, even one of mine, to a situation without serious weighing of the context. As I fear not the child with a weapon he cannot lift, I will never fear the mind of a man who does not think. So think, my dear reader, as a soldier retreats from a battle he cannot win, as a woman rejects a home that shows her only violence, as a family finds hope in walking away from dying fields during a season of too much rain, as a king leaves a people with the gift of his absence so that they may grow and solve their own problems without his hand to always guide them, may you have the courage to someday walk away and the wisdom to recognize that day when it arrives." I really enjoyed this parable. I was hoping for something a little bit more profound, I will be honest, but it was nice. And I'm more curious if this is going to apply to Dalinar or to Kaladin moving forward, because both of them, I assume Kaladin's about to read it. Or have it read to him, I should say. But I don't know. What'd you guys think? Fourth parable of the Way of Kings.
Yeah, my thoughts were pretty much identical to yours. Enjoyed it. Definitely love getting a little bit of information from Know-It-On. I'll take all we can get. I like the sentiment of what it's talking about there, of sometimes the right decision is to walk away. I think that's true. He references one aspect of leadership in that you can't always do things for the people that you're leading. And there does come a time where people need to be able to stand on their own 2 feet, and, you know, stepping back and letting people fight their own fight sometimes is the right approach to something. So yeah, I dig it. Not quite sure how it's relevant to our story or where it's going to come in, but I dig it.
I like the sentiment of not taking a quote and standing firm on it, if that makes sense. A quote out of context kind of mentions that a bit, of like, don't take one thing that I say. I'm fully paraphrasing this in poorly. Don't take a quote that I say and make it justify everything. I really appreciate that sentiment. I feel like that's my one takeaway of like a little real life thing. It's really easy for people to find one shred of evidence or one quote and really base a lot of things off of it. Whenever there's a lot more context to be added, and a lot of times situations aren't that linear. So linear or yeah, one that clear cut. So I just thought that was neat, very, very profound. So yeah, those are my only thoughts on it.
I almost feel like Brandon Sanderson is talking to us as Noadon in this one specifically, because within the context of the Way of Kings in world, Noadon is already famous, and he writes about himself as people are taking his own advice as he's publishing the Way of Kings. Like, people have already heard of him. This group that he runs into in this parable have heard of him and are reshaping their entire family's life around, you know, a story about Noadon and how he got to Urithiru. And Noadon is saying, hey, even if you take one of my inspirational quotes, you can't then go use that to anything. You need to critically think about your own life and, you know, apply these good morals, even if they are good morals, if I do say so myself, says Noadon. You have to then apply it to your own life and, you know, have some critical thinking. And I almost wonder if this is Brandon saying this of like, yeah, I recognize I'm famous. I understand that you still need to apply it to your own life. Like, you can't just, you know, keep these one-liners and hold on to them. You then have to go live. That's what I pulled out of it.
I didn't think about it that way, but that's actually pretty clever. That definitely could be some of his thoughts spilling into these sentiments here. I kind of like that.
Anything else? Okay, back into our story. Chapter 31, we have The Experiment is the title of the chapter. We go down into the laundry room of Urithiru to open the perpendicularity, and Hoid goes back and forth about, yep, I was there on Ashen, no big deal, I know I'm cool, you don't have to say so. And Shallan also has a point of view, but that's kind of just setting up for the battle, which is in the next chapter, so we can leave that. The Dalinar, Navan, go ahead.
I want to mention something actually completely off topic before we get into kind of like the character motivation analysis and all this kind of stuff. There is a line in this chapter that I read and did like a triple take on. And I posted about this in my live reactions. And I think like one of you guys out there backed me up and shared a similar thought. But on page 284, if you have the copy, there's a line that stuck out to me as rather strange. There's a new character we've met, a Windrunner named, audiobook people, you're going to have to help me out here.
Isasic.
Isasic.
Yes.
Which seems rather similar to the name Isaac.
Yeah.
Both it's, in sound it's like, and on the page.
Hold on. Just let me throw this out there. It's like the word, it's like the name Stargyle. You couldn't have like camouflaged it any better than that, Brandon. You just had to put Stargyle in there as in,
yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
Steve Argyle.
Yeah. But yes, he throws in Isasic, not as one character, but two separate characters named Isasic.
Yeah, and so here's the line. It's like, blah, 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 Isasic the Windrunner said. And I think we're in Shallan. This is like Shallan POV. So this is like Shallan thought. This wasn't the cartographer, but the other Isasic, a shorter man with an excitable demeanor. And I was like, okay, what? That's a reference to something. And then it occurred to me at that point that Isasic is rather close to Isaac, who happens to be the one who does the maps for Brandon Sanderson's book.
Correct.
Shout out Correct. To Mr. Isaac Stewart. And Isaac is also a little shorter than most. And so I couldn't help but read this whole sentence with the, is this a joke? This is a joke. Is it Isaac Stewart joke?
That is just an Isaac Stewart joke. There's nothing more to it.
Oh, okay.
Brandon has to continue to sneak all the people in his life into these books. He's only got so much time left to make it into the front half of Stormlight, you know, the bulk there.
I wouldn't mind if he snuck it in. This is not sneaking it in. There are two characters named Isasic, and one of them is a cartographer. The other one is a short, happy little Windrunner guy. Like, okay. Like, needs to be a little bit more sneaky.
Is this where I confess that I did not pick up on this, though? I heard the name Isasic, and I was like, that's a cool name. I will say Starguile is probably worse. Like that's
Starguile is pretty bad.
That's pretty rough. Like that's pretty blatant. But Isasic, if on its own, I wasn't instantly like Isaac. You know, like it took me a bit.
But, I think if you'd seen it on the page, you would have done that's that, what Elliot did.
You're probably right.
Yeah, probably doesn't warrant any more analysis than that, but I chuckled and kind of rolled my eyes a little bit.
Okay. Dalinar and Devani set up their perpendicularity, and they tether themselves via light to the floor that they're standing on, jump into the portal, which we'll get more back to the portal later after the battle with the Ghostbloods. But Hoyt has a couple cryptic lines of, yes, I was there for Ashen. Take this rock with you. It'll tether you to the place that I'm thinking of. It'll give you like a direction, a compass in the spiritual realm. And good luck, because I'm scared to go with you. I'm not going in there. That's how he leaves them. So, with the results of this at the end of this couple chapters out, notwithstanding, how do you guys feel about jumping into the spiritual realm?
I'll just say that Wit is rather nonchalant about the whole thing, or at least kind of feels like it. Like, he's got his pretty roll with the punches kind of thing. Here's a rock. Here's a plan. Yeah, hop in there. I'm pretty terrified about this, but hey, it's going to be fine. And then after the whole thing, you were joking about cartoon version of Wit and Lift pretending nothing happened. But even after the end of it all, Wit's still like, oh, that's bad. Moving on. And it's like, all right, buddy.
It's quite a huge thing to drop that Hoyt is like, yeah, oh yeah, by the way, I was there whenever humans came to Roshar. That was a big drop, big reveal. And I'm very excited that he said, like, okay, yeah, go see for yourself. Like, you'll see, we'll compare notes to see if it lines up.
Is it
total lame move that he didn't just share? Like, oh yeah, this is what happened, so you know.
Right.
Like, he's definitely postponing that to be a reveal later in the book. Like, I feel like that would have come up a while ago, just with several of the things that happened, even back to Oathbringer, but... Yeah, that was quite a thing to drop, but I have to say, I'm really, really looking forward to seeing what is going to happen in the spiritual realm. People get sucked in there. Gavinor gets it sucked in there, so we'll...
I was far less interested in what was about to happen in the spiritual realm until Gavinor got sucked in, and I was like, okay, now I really care about what is about to happen in there.
Yeah, I guess we can go ahead and talk about the outcome, like chapter 33 and stuff, of the perpendicularity. Let's go ahead. I am very curious if we're about to walk into some time dilation stuff. It was mentioned several times in these chapters of keep the watch on you, keep track of time. You can lose track of time in there. We're going to keep your bodies here to make sure you don't get time dilated in there. Oh, whoops, your bodies fell in. Like, kind of circling back to, we're at the end of day two and well into this book. Like, we're nearly a third of the way through the book. And I wonder if we're about to hit some serious time dilation stuff with every character that just fell in. So I think we'll probably keep with day 3 through 10 with everybody who's outside the portal. Yasna, Adolin, Kaladin, you know, everybody is going to go through their normal 10 days. I wonder if we're going to get like 4 scenes between day 3 and day 10 of Dalinar, Shallan, Relaine, Renarin, everybody that just fell in. And then they'll come back out and it's day 10.
I'm conflicted on that, Trevor. It's obviously going to be different. They're going to be kind of pitted against each other, the real world, like real physical realm time, what's happening, and then the time, the weird not time doesn't add up right. That's going to be happening in the spiritual realm. Elliot, do you have any thoughts on this first? If not, what you're welcome to share. I have to make a confession to y'all, and I will come back. But I want you to get a chance to say anything you want to say before I go.
I'll just say one quick thing to play off of what Trevor was talking about, and then we can go wild or wherever you're about to go with it. I had some similar time dilation thoughts as you, Trevor, only I think I went the other way. I'm thinking now, what if our folks in the spiritual realm are going to spend like a year there, 5 years there, 10 years there, and then they're going to come back and it's day 7. And all of our theories about like child Gavinor could get completely thrown for a left turn if like 18-year-old Gavinor walks out of the perpendicularity back into our time.
Shallan's kids. Just saying.
Yeah. I was going to say, Hoyd says roughly something about it'll feel like 20 years. He throws that number out like a while ago. I'm pretty confident he threw, because they were asking about like,
he does throw out a number. I don't remember what it is. Yeah.
You could look back. I'm pretty confident it was 20 years. I that number really stuck in my head because I remember thinking on that for a long time. And that comes into what I was going to say. Elliot, you actually kind of hit the nail on the head, but my confession is that this whole time, I unfortunately knew that this was going to happen. While we were at Dragonsteel, I got this spoiled. I was talking with someone at our booth, and I was just like, do you have any predictions on book 5? And someone was like, I think Gavinor is going to be Odium's champion. Or actually, sorry. He said that Gavinor was going to be the champion instead of Dalinar. That was the prediction. And I was like, how do you get there? He said, well, when everyone gets sucked into the spiritual realm, Gavinor got sucked in too. And I was like, I'm not supposed to know this yet. I am definitely not supposed to know this. So this whole time I'm like, when is this going to happen? And here it happened. So I imagine that's a pretty decent or common theory at this point, is that time goes differently here. We could have a fully grown, developed Gavinor coming out. I could, in an honorable way, like in the Gavinor is going to do great things. I feel like you could even see a fulfillment of the redemption arc of Elokar through Gavinor, which would be really cool.
Oh, okay. Like, interesting.
In that way, like, you know, I'll come back to this. I'm going to come back to why I think that might would happen. But the flip side is Gavinor has effectively 20 years to mull and be angry about and consumed with rage, or heaven forbid, any other unmade or things that are in here, making him a fully grown man coming out, and Dalinar is not fighting 5-year-old Gavinor, but 25-year-old Gavinor, you know, at the Contest of Champions. I'm going to back up slightly because the ways that this could happen, I think all the people who have been thrown into the spiritual realm, we've talked a lot about like, oh, they're going to learn so much. We're gonna learn all the secrets of Roshar. We're gonna learn the secrets of the Heralds. All these things. Time is different. I think they say like the past, present, and future kind of blend together. I think our characters are gonna reface tests or face new tests. Gavinor could be tormented by the things that have already tormented him once again. He could see his mom and his dad die. Like he could see all these horrible things. He could also see the honor that Elokar did hold at the end, the way he grew, and be inspired, or other things in the past that could inspire him. Likewise, Dalinar has mostly moved past his past with Evie and the thrill and everything, but that could easily come back up and be absolutely devastating to relive and re-see, like right. Physically seeing it in front of you,
right,
from his point of view. I think it's very easy for a lot of situations like that to happen, and that's what I'm really expecting. Is I'm expecting some answers, but I'm expecting a lot of trials instead. It may be how those trials are dealt with, which lead to good. It could be a challenge. I don't know. That's my like predictions and theories. But my confession was that I've actually unfortunately known that it was like the worst thing to get spoiled on as far as preview chapters is everyone gets sucked into the spiritual realm. And I just had to try to hold on to that and not say anything about it. So
you did a good job.
Thankfully, I can now go forward having no idea what's happening. So I much prefer that.
I'm going to be very disappointed if we don't actually learn true things about Ancient Roshar. That has been teased for the first section of this book. And if that doesn't actually happen, and if we end up reliving stuff we've already seen, I'm going to be pretty disappointed. I don't think that'll happen. I think we are going to get genuine answers to honor dying, ashen, you know, all of these, the shattered planes. So these questions that have always been lurking on the back shelf since the Way of Kings. Shout out to our Elliot having all those random one-liner questions at the end of the Way of Kings. I do think many of those will be addressed before we come back into the physical realm. The trial thing, though, is an interesting idea. I wonder if the fact that everybody's physical body, even the Spren, like Pattern and Testament, I think, are also sucked in here. I wonder if there's like a physical danger. If we die in the spiritual realm, we die type thing, you know? Because their bodies are physically in the spiritual realm, whatever that means.
I do want to add, Trevor, I fully agree. I think we will get a lot of those big answers. I don't think the primary focus is going to be like, oh, remember what you went through in Oathbringer, getting past Evie and, you know, accepting the responsibility. I don't think that will be the main thing, but I think there are going to be challenges. And my main thing is I think we're going to see not like four moments, but like a lot of content. I think we're going to see quite a bit in the spiritual realm. That's my prediction. That's once again maybe more of a wish list than a backed up prediction, but I think we're going to have more of that and less of the daily happenings. We're definitely going to have scenes of showing the ongoing wars at each of our places as they're happening, but I think we're more so going to have spiritual realm craziness.
I don't think this is necessarily a prediction, but it's more of a fear of mine. I fear the exact opposite of what you just said, that we're actually not going to get any scenes in the spiritual realm. And the next time we see these characters are going to be them stepping out. And then what they experienced and what they learned is then going to be like drip fed to us throughout the rest of the book. Like as we spend time interacting with them, we'll like slowly learn what all happened in there. That's what I fear.
I didn't think of that as a possibility. That is absolutely not going to happen. And so I'm not afraid of that.
I I can't deny that I am afraid of that, because I would be rather sad. Because my biggest thing is I want to see, I want some description, some setting for the spiritual realm. I understand that you probably can't have, like, I think I mentioned before we started this book, like, you know, we have the map of Roshar and we have the map of Shadesmar. Like, would there be a map that we might get of the spiritual realm? To my understanding, that's impossible. You couldn't do such a thing. But I'm like, we need to at least, like, see them. How do you get around? How do you, what does it look like to you? I just need, yeah, need to see some stuff.
Are Dalinar and Navani making it back in time for the contest? Or does Kaladin have to step up? Predictions, gentlemen.
Okay. I was thinking about this, because in the same vein that Gavinor comes back, hypothetically fully grown and a player in this contest, in the same way, I'm like, does 20 years passing with Dalinar make it more challenging for him? You know, I don't remember his age, but he's like he's a bit up there in years, not like old, but 20 years is a bit tougher, you know?
Dalinar and Navani are young grandparents. Like, Gavinor is technically Navani's grandson, right? So they're what, mid-60s?
Yeah. That's my thought. The reason why I feel like they're not going to be affected is simply because of the artwork. You remember that artwork of Dalinar walking up the steps, we assume to be to the Contest of Champions.
Yeah.
And that, you know, he looks like how Dalinar looks normally. So I'm thinking he hasn't physically aged 20 additional years by this point.
I think the aging thing makes a lot of sense and would fit into the story rather easily for Gavinor. And not for any of the other characters. It would mess some things up seriously. Like, Shallan just went in. At least we are kind of assuming that Shallan went in.
Renarin and Merlin as well, yeah.
Right. And Adolin stayed behind. So 25-year-old Adolin, who married 21-year-old Shallan, is soon to be married to 41-year-old Shallan? Like,
That would make me laugh. I can't lie. That'd be hilarious.
Right?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's going to be some stipulation that maybe there is not a physical aging, at least of 20 years. But I mean, we need to look back at that. But I'm pretty, I'm like 99% confident that Hoid said something along the lines of, like, if your physical body's in there, it could be 20 years, you know?
Well, so, okay. Here's the reason why I went with the other direction of short amount of time in the spiritual realm means long amount of time in the physical realm. I have been looking at this book and I've been thinking, okay, how on earth are we covering so many characters? I mean, there's a lot of pages, don't get me wrong, but we got a lot of stuff to cover in 10 days. What if we took Dalinar, Navani, Shallan, Renarin, and Relaine just off the table for half the book and then brought them back? Like, and we saw maybe like four scenes. That's where I went with, okay, we're still going to get days 1 through 10. Except day 3 through 10 is going to be way shorter than 1 and 2, because half our characters are gone.
I think logistically that makes more sense, what the time dilations you're talking about. Also, Hoid seemed to be trying to warn them about, hey, don't forget what you're in there for. If you get distracted, you'll come out. And it kind of the implication there being like more time will have passed here than in there. That seemed to be the warning.
Yes.
So, but this could go a lot of ways, I think.
I absolutely see what you mean. I'm very curious. I I could really see it going either way. The thing is, yeah, I think a lot of the characters in there are pretty much like set that if they leave for a third of the book and come back, then we haven't really missed too much, you know, other than the fact that they're in the spiritual realm and right. What they might see.
Other there. Than whatever they're doing in there.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But Dalinar is the main one who, like, I expect we should see, you know, that quote, the secrets of the heralds or whatever they mentioned before, and on finding out about honor and Tanavast and things like that. So there's definitely some moments we are supposed to see. I have the feeling that it may not be four scenes, but it may just be pushed back a little bit. Like, we may go through day three or day three and four without coming back. Like, we might be kind of left on this cliffhanger for a while. And then day five picks up, and it's like Dalinar and company wander through the spirit. You know, it picks up there.
I just think it's so funny that ten chapters ago, we had this plan. Okay, what if we went and peeked into the spiritual realm and looked at where Honor is? Okay, that was one person going to the spiritual realm. Okay, fast forward. Like 14 people just went into the spiritual realm. Like, if you count all the Spren and the Ghostbloods and the Ghostbloods Spren, and like, there's a lot of people that just got vacuumed into the spiritual realm in 10 seconds. I just thought that was really funny.
So we could probably talk for an entire episode about the spiritual realm stuff, but I've got like six things that happen in the midst of all this that I wanted to talk about with you guys. We should probably try and jump into some of those. The first couple are Shallan related.
Okay.
Paul, you actually noticed this first one. In chapter 31, Shallan just like mentions to herself, oh yeah, human and Spren are pretty cool. I should write a book about that. And then it moves on. I didn't take anything from that until I saw your note on that. I was like, oh, that's actually interesting.
Yeah, I was going to say, she makes some comment, and I don't even remember exactly what I wrote. It's been a second. I'm going to go. She makes some comment about truth in this, I believe, in this chapter, and then talks about this. And I'm like, it would so make sense. It would make so much sense, actually, that she would write the bond of Spren and human, the Knights of Wind and Truth. It kind of flows, and I was like, why haven't I even considered her? We have considered her as a potential, you know, author of the in-world Knights of Wind and Truth, but we keep going back to Kaladin, Dalinar. I think I even threw Zeth out there because I love Zeth. All sorts of things, but Shallan makes perfect sense. She's a scholar, and yeah, it just makes so much sense. I don't think this is going to happen, for the record. I will actually say there's no way this happens, but it popped into my mind, so now I'm going to share it. What if they come out of the spiritual realm? Time is different there. What if they come out with the book? She writes the book.
She wrote a book.
Pops out. 2 days later, with a fully written, massive novel, not novel, like, you know, textbook on Spren and the Nile Bond, etc.
And
kind of neat. I don't think that's what's going to happen.
And potentially about events that haven't happened yet, from where we're at.
You mentioned that, it is great that Shallan is here, because she has this like photographic memory.
That's true. Yeah.
It absolutely makes sense that she's going to, hopefully, she'll see these major moments in history that are just undocumented, except for Hoid, I guess, maybe at some of these, and be able to remember frame for frame what happens and write it all down when she gets back. I think she instantly in this chapter went to my number one. I think I'm putting my chips on it. I think she's going to be the author of Knights and Wind and Truth, the in-world
not time dilated Gavinor.
It's a close second.
All right. I might have to make fun of you for that Gavinor time dilation theory, just so you know.
Yes. I also see that I wrote in that same thing. I found it. I did also write there that Hoyd mentions that they will age roughly 20 years. So I was thinking about that.
There's another crazy Shallan part of this. I'm sure you guys noticed it because it stood out to me immediately. As they're battling the Ghostbloods, Radiant, I think the book even uses, is separates from Shallan in physical form and fights the Ghostbloods separately from Shallan.
Yeah, but she already did that against the fused guy back on day one.
That's a bit different because Shallan was like light weaving, essentially. She was actively right. Like, I'm going to light weave Radiant with sword in hand to scare away and stab the fused, right? But here it was more of like a I don't know if it's unconscious or what.
It wasn't earth-shattering because of that previous scene that we saw. That the fact that, yeah, a light weaving could take physical form, that was already kind of a bomb we've wrestled with before. But this was like, it almost felt like Radiant was taking the initiative to say, all right, Shallan, you're useless, I'll do this. Steps out of Shallan, does the things, and then at the end goes back. Like, maybe it is just as simple as Radiant is taking control, light weaving a shape, taking action. That probably is the answer here. But it felt different.
I was not wowed by this because both of them happened in the cognitive realm. They're in Shadesmar for both, and Radiant steps out and starts punching people. It was a wow factor on day one. I did not bat an eye at that here. Because it happened in the cognitive realm again.
So what you're saying is you're waiting for this to happen like in the physical realm. If it happens there, you're going to go, oh my gosh, that was crazy.
If she shakes Radiant's hand in the physical realm, then we can have a discussion.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Well, and actually there is an interesting thought here. And it has to do with the spiritual realm. Is Radiant going to be a different character in the spiritual realm?
Like just permanent, like another member of the band.
Correct.
Yeah, if she can do it for a few seconds in battle, why not all the time?
Right. I don't know.
I frankly think that she won't, for the record. I don't have too much to base it off of other than I think the way that the cognitive realm works, that it's the whole cognitive realm and the cognitive aspects that we look at are so tied to your perception of she's thought so much through Radiant's mindset that it almost makes sense that it's become so real to her it could take a physical form in the cognitive realm. I feel like the spiritual realm might be more cut and dry of like, it says it's where like the souls of yourself are. So it depends on whether or not Radiant is a legitimate, like a standalone, has a soul thing. And I don't know that that's the case. I don't think that's the case. So my marbles would be in the basket that Radiant would not be in the spiritual realm. Maybe there'll be some connection. I don't know. But that's my speculation.
Paul, once again, shutting down theories on the podcast.
Yes, I know. I've turned over a new leaf, and it's not a particular leaf I like.
I actually agree with you here. If Radiant does manifest separately in the spiritual realm, that would imply to me that she is a separate soul, which gets really odd really fast. So, I mean, that's Shallan's middle name, so really odd really fast. So
That's true. It's Shallan really odd really fast. I guess Colin now.
Colin, yes. DeVar. Lift. We have to talk about Lift.
Yes, that was my next question.
Lift sees like She describes it as an alternate version of herself had she never left Rahl Ellerim. And my Mistborn alarms went off in my head of, yo, somebody's burning the 11th metal. We're seeing an alternate version of what could have been for Lyft as this perpendicularity opens. Like, it was a huge parallel for me.
I guess I kind of missed it. I absolutely see what you're saying, but when I read this, it just was like, I was hearing it as like Lyft is reminiscing or, you know, guessing. But I think you're right. I think there's probably some investiture going on here. They also make mention that Lyft is like really highly invested.
Yes.
In here also. Like
I was waiting for the Elantrian mention from Hoyd. Like design drops in Yumi.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking of. Like in Yumi, there's a mention of someone being like, oh my gosh, you like design is like you are very highly invested, like way above normal levels. And that's essentially what they say about Lyft here. And we talked about it a little bit before. I think Lyft is going to be stepping more and more out of the background into the forefront. And this whole, she's so highly invested. She has Cultivation's touch on her. I don't know if this is just a little nod and she's going to be more back half, but I think she's going to be more relevant here. I don't know if Elliot had more thoughts on that. Afterwards, I'm very eager to talk about the emotions going on with Lyft here. Is a big step.
I said one thought before you get into the character side of what's going on with Lyft here. There's a mention very early on in the chapter. I want to see what you guys thought, if this is literal or if this is figurative. She'd been near Dalinar's perpendicularity before, but the wonder still struck her every time. That powerful illumination shining straight through her, making her transparent. Do you guys read that literally? Or is that just a metaphor talking about how bright the light is?
I didn't pick up on that until you just read that, I'll be honest. I just had this crazy theory of what if Lyft is like a cognitive shadow and she doesn't know about it.
Exactly. That's exactly where my head went.
Another thing to add to that.
What if she died?
Trevor, that's not crazy. You say that, but like, that's not. So I hadn't really thought about it that way until Elliot brought that point up, but I kind of think that's the case. Very highly invested, no telling how or when or whatever. Obviously something has happened. But also, another piece of evidence for this is she can physically interact with Wendell, her spren, right? That was the weird thing whenever you're introduced to her, is you're like, okay, runs off of food and can physically like stand on top of her sprint, like can climb on Wendell.
Yeah.
And you're like, that's not how this works.
You know, and that's what Wendell says. It's like, I got no idea why you can do that, but okay.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's absolutely not okay. So it's all been chalked up to, she's been to the cultivation. Like she's been to cultivation and has a curse and a boon. Whatever, right? And so, yeah, that explains it, right? But isn't she also permanently 11 years old?
Yes, she is. But she's okay. She's been permanently 11 years old for like the past 5 years, except now she's 14 in the last year.
That's true.
But
that's tied to her like boon and curse, right? Like don't we get confirmation of that?
We assumed so. Like I think she went to the Night Watcher and asked not to age. And like Teravangian and Dalinar, cultivation steps in and does something else.
Okay.
But Lyft just talked about it in this chapter. I can't admit that I think my mom is still alive. What if Lyft died and her mom is still alive? What if she saved her mom and then preserves herself as herself to not confront whatever? There's half a thought there.
There's definitely something really big going on here. And that was all I was going to bring up. We were really crazy really quick. Was like, yeah, you know, Lyft. So Lyft has been among the least serious characters in the entire story. The most serious you see her is maybe some stuff in Edge Dancer, the novella, but she's not even like serious there. There's some moments where she's in serious trouble, but that's about it. She doesn't really take anything seriously. She's a very rebellious. I think of like a Tom Sawyer type of like, you know, just a rebellious, getting into trouble, running around, no rules type of kid. But we're definitely getting a shift to maybe why she went to cultivation, the pain she feels with losing her mother, that I'm like, okay, this is going to start to shift. This is going to start to shift where she, I guess, is more vulnerable, has more of like a serious development. Definitely making a shift. But the stuff we were throwing around now, I'm like, man, I don't know what that could be. What kind of reveal? It could be that she has literally been dead and is a cognitive shadow.
We just paralleled her to Yumi without making that last final step of design tells Yumi, hey, you're glowing like an Elantrian and you need to calm down. And then Hoid says, yeah, you glow brighter than anyone else I've ever seen. What if they're both cognitive shadows and didn't know it? That's exactly what Yumi was at the time. She was a cognitive shadow and just didn't have the answer before she had the equation. What if the same thing with Lyft? She's died sometime in the past and just doesn't know.
These are all the thoughts that I was having. There's a couple things that come up in my mind, though, that maybe go against this, and that wouldn't that be fairly obvious to Wendell? Wouldn't that be something that Wendell knows easily?
But isn't that something that... Yeah, no, I was thinking the same thing, Elliot. Like, when he's like, you're not supposed to be able to climb on me or, like, interact with me. But don't we see that? We keep referencing Yumi because that's our connection here. Like, they don't say anything or know any... Like, Design does not know anything. Design just says, you're very highly invested.
That is true. Design doesn't
but know. But not like... Is not like... In a lot of stuff about like your spirit web is very intriguing or things like that, but
the nightmares know, but Design does not know.
Yeah, so I think that they can't fully tell. Like that would be my synopsis. We haven't seen that. Like we have not seen a cognitive shadow that is bonded to a spren. Like that is not, unless this is the case, then this is the example. But like, yeah, we have yet to see that. We don't know. Like we know if someone who is highly invested on Roshar, who's bonded to a spren, dies, then maybe we'd see what happens there. But yeah, we have not seen that yet. So it's like, does the Nile bond end after a physical death of the Radiant?
I just had a really dumb thought that what if Kaladin is dying and that's why he can start touching Syl?
Oh my gosh. That's how they get the what's the name for it? The Syladin or whatever?
Syladin, yeah.
The Syladin relationship comes about because he loses his physical body, becomes a cognitive shadow so that they can live happily ever after.
Correct.
On their little cozy cottage in Shadesmar or something.
And all of this based on four words in a sentence that say the light made her transparent.
True. Yeah. True. Which could be figurative. That could be like, oh, it's a really bright light. Yeah, I can't even see myself anymore. You know, it's that bright. So
it's,
I guess
it's also determined it's also that. Lift perspective. So who knows how reliable that is?
That's true.
True.
Yeah. Oh, man. We haven't talked about Zeth yet. We need to talk about Zeth, man. And Kaladin and Ishar.
And Odium.
Well, yeah, we'll get to the interludes here in a second, but okay.
Yeah.
Shinovar. We're camped out in Shinovar. Kaladin and Zeth have a little powwow. Kaladin goes off to... Well, let's talk about Zeth real quick. They notice that all the lights and the candles and the campfires are non-existent in Shinovar. Is Shinovar abandoned, gentlemen? We haven't met anyone yet, besides Magic Ishar.
Okay, I don't think Shinovar is going to be abandoned. I think Shinovar is going to be, like, they're going to find people are in hiding, or there's something else going on. I don't know. Maybe they're at a town hall meeting about what the heck is going on in the world across the misted mountains. I don't think it's going to be, like, everyone's gone entirely. They're dead. There's no Shin left. I think we're going to find the big concentration of Shin people all at once, if they're not soon.
And Ishar has recently taken up residence in Shinovar, so he's very much on a power trip. I could totally see him coming in and reshaping everything and dragging everybody into the same city and saying, you work for me now, doing stuff like that.
His disciples. He calls them.
Yes. I think he uses this term disciple twice, once for Kaladin and once for Zeth.
Mm-hmm.
I do like the fact that in this chapter, Brandon Sanderson has just like thrown all of the hard magic to the wind and it's like, yeah, Ishar just appears there. Just deal with it. Like, I don't want to have to, you know, construct some way that he could have done this. No, he just appears and disappears, just, you know, because I want him to.
Well, no, you're right, and you get the sense that it's like, okay, they're sent out here to clean Shinovar and to find Ishar. It's like for the actual development that they want, that I'm sure Brandon wants to happen with Ishar. We got to get this ball rolling. Like, it can't be like a day six, day seven, we find him. That's too late. So, like, yeah. The first guy that they actually run into is the right guy. Like, we're going to get to the point. That is where I felt that was going, which I'm really excited about. I'm all for it. I wanted to ask that it spends a lot of time relative to how much Brandon uses to describe things. He used a lot of time describing Ishar's appearance and presence. Like, a lot of, it felt reminiscent to like Warbreaker almost, Sesebron, like warping the air around him. Maybe not quite to that level, but it just mentioned like a presence. Like, everything got still, wind and everything got still when he walked up. Like, they knew they would deal with a bad Mamba Jamba, you know, when Ishar walked up. And I felt like that was way more intense than how we saw him before. I could be wrong. I haven't actually I'm also rereading the Stormlight Archive. I did not catch up in time. So I haven't gotten to where Ishar enters the scene in like Rhythm of War and such. And so is he described the same, or is this an Ishar who is pursued even greater power and things like that since last time we saw him?
It's Ishar who has abandoned Tezim or whatever his previous alter ego was. And he says that in the chapter. It's like, yeah, Dalinar talked to me and I realized I no longer need to hide. So here I am, God Ishar. And he's like, all glowing, you know.
That's so true.
No, he has not appeared like this before. But the descriptions that you're referring to, like about his robes and his jewelry and stuff, you're supposed to read into this is legit where the Vorin church came from. like all of the Ardents dressed like this, all of like the Takama that we've been dueling in for three books comes from this guy and how this guy dresses. The religion is based off this guy, is what you're supposed to see.
You're right. They make a mention that it's like the father of the Ardents, essentially, like the what they do, their procedures. I thought it was really cool. I can't wait to see Ishar more.
Ishar leans into that too. He calls himself the Almighty. He thinks he is. I mean, it's hard to tell. Does he think he's Honor?
I think he thinks he's Honor's champion.
He says that to Dalinar, right? Yeah.
Yes. He says that in Rhythm of War, that he's the champion, not Dalinar.
And I think he says in this chapter too, when Dalinar comes up, he goes, oh yeah, the false champion.
Yeah. But okay, so when I listened to this for the first time and it was like, and Ishar showed up, and then we got a switch to, I think it was like a Lopin point of view or something.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's a huge cliffhanger. And then I wrote down all my notes of like, okay, is this smart Ishar? Is he still crazy? Blah, blah, blah. And I wrote out all this stuff. And then like two pages later, we go back to Kaladin. And I was like, oh, we're actually going to get this conversation, which obviously we would, because they're split into days and the next. Anyway, I wasn't thinking very clearly. But is this saying Ishar is what I'm trying to ask? And the answer is no. No, it is not.
Well, at least now. But once Kaladin has a couple conversations, you know, he'll be all clear. His mind will be cleared. He'll be healed. Be great. Therapy. Which, by the way, last note on the Kaladin Zeth chapter. The only thing that I need to say is, it seems like we are seeing the start of the development we talked about. Kaladin makes this stew and he's thinking about Rock's stew and is like, I'm going to make this great stew. It's going to be awesome. We're going to become friends around like exactly how Bridge 4 bonded. And then he does it and it's a big flop and it's disgusting. He's like, why did I think I could match Rock's standard? He was a great cook. But, and Zeth has already eaten his ration bars that he has. But he tries it, and they both admit that while it's not good, it's better than the ration bars that they have, like an MRE, I guess. And that's just like a little start where Zeth says, if you make this again, I'll have some. Which I was glad to see, because Zeth, as we know, would absolutely be like, nope, I have ration bars. That is sustaining to me. That is all I need. This is almost allowing for him to feel something nice, to have some nicer food when presented. So maybe we'll find out that Zeth is a foodie, and that's really the way to his heart is through his stomach. If so, then I could relate so well.
They just need a Kaladin Zeth cooking show, and everything would be all right.
Exactly. They need to get Zeth hooked up with Rock, and just go from there, and he'll be better in no time. But that's the only thing I really wanted to say about that. It feels like we're turning over that leaf with Kaladin and Zeth.
Zeth does seem to finally be opening up a little bit. He has stuck to his line firmly every time Kaladin has tried to have a conversation with him. And he finally starts to go, okay, maybe we should talk about this. Or maybe we should go visit my old home and see what's there, you know, kinds of things. But I'm actually really fascinated now by this whole dynamic of where Zeth is at. I think we've talked about this before, but it's coming back up again. And I'm excited if this is going to be like a major theme we get to explore more. Zeth is clinging to this idea of, I have done terrible things, therefore I deserve torment. And Kaladin fires back this line at some point where he says, well, I should probably find it to quote it, but he basically says, like, you shouldn't have to hurt or something like that. Or I should try and find it.
So Zeth accuses him of being immoral if he heals Zeth. And Kaladin says, no, that's just not true. It is not immoral to heal.
It's not immoral to stop hurting Zeth, is what he says.
Look at me. I'm so good.
You were far closer than I was. And I think that's a fantastic question that I hope we keep exploring this more. Does Zeth deserve suffering because of the evil that he's done? That is a big question. That is a big, big question.
And I'm sure we're going to address it because of this whole blame thing in early Zeth chapters that we talked about last week. Who takes responsibility for moving the stone? And who takes responsibility if the truth stone, or whatever he calls it in the Way of Kings, is actually
just a stone? Yeah.
If his oath stone is just a stone, you know, Zeth's entire childhood is who takes the blame for these things. So, you know. Okay. We're going to speed this up. Theme for day two, Elliot, go.
Yes, theme. The theme stood out to me fairly quickly as I was going back through the chapters from day two. I think there was a lot of strategy in this day. So that is what I'm going for. There was all those scenes of Shallan versus the Ghostbloods are in day two. So there was a lot of back and forth strategy, who can outmaneuver the other. Then we've gotten now this consistent run of, I don't know quite how the interlude should fit into my themes, but I'm just running with it. Cultivation is acting on quite a bit of preconceived strategy. She's like been planning out a lot of this, and now she's starting to make some moves. So, and we're starting to see some of that. We're starting to see some of that kind of happen before our eyes here. I think Kaladin and Zeth are even engaging in a bit of strategy. How do we go about this exploring Shinovar? They don't just kind of charge right in. They're thinking about it. Kaladin's trying to kind of strategize. How do I connect with Zeth? How do I connect with Ishar? Ishar clearly has some crazy strategies going on. I don't know what the heck is going on there. But then, of course, all the Dalinar scenes as well are full of strategy as well. We spent a whole, like, two chapters just planning out battle strategies and who's going to go where and who's going to sit here. And we think we're going to get attacked here. Let's go there. So I think strategy had to be my theme for day two. And I'm realizing right now that I'm going to have to do 10 of these instead of my normal 5 for a book. Mm-hmm. So a little more
presumably mental gymnastics.
True.
I think it's a pretty safe bet. Okay. Interlude 3. We're going to do L first and then Odium second. L walks into the vault in Kolinar, finds Yezrian, kills him, and then has a chat with Odium about taking over his army. Any thoughts? I have a couple, but...
I have one that's going to get me in a lot of trouble. Can y'all remind me... Okay, I'm sorry. I'm just going to apologize. We don't need to ask questions. Can y'all remind me when we first saw L and who L is?
I can tell you exactly where we first saw L. Okay, so L shows up in the second to last chapter of Rhythm of War. And
okay,
what's his face? The Pursuer. What's his actual name? The Pursuer?
Lesian or Let
Lesian. Thank you. Yeah. Lesian the Pursuer is throwing a tantrum in the Kolinar Palace as he's returned for like the fifth time or whatever after Kaladin's killed him a bunch. Throwing a tantrum, L is sitting there in the throne room or in an upper room of Kolinar. I don't remember. And the Pursuer is throwing a tantrum, blah, 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 blah. And then L says, it's okay. You don't need to throw a tantrum anymore, and kills him with anti-void light. It was the first time besides like the little thing we had with Raboniel and her daughter and stuff like that. But this is the first time that outside of your Thiru, it's sent to Kolinar, anti-void light. He uses it on the Pursuer. Pursuer dies at the end of Rhythm of War. So we know, okay, he's no longer after Kaladin, but who's L? He came back and killed the Pursuer. First time we saw him.
Okay, that's right. Okay, thank you. You did the refresher.
I also have a slot on my bingo board that says that L has a hemallergic spike, which this chapter did not reveal, but I'm still confident that will be a thing in the future.
That I'm trying to remember that chapter that there was a like a pretty substantial theory about some hemolytic spike, or there was some metal in that chapter that I was just summarizing. I don't remember it well enough to know though.
But whoever L is, and whether he's got hemolurgy or not, he takes out Yezrian or Yezrian's soul, what's left of it, but he also like multiple times refers to him as my friend, which is interesting. Yeah. And Odium even asks him about this. He's like, you just killed that guy and you called him your friend. Curious what that past connection is.
I'm fascinated why he has no rhythms. He speaks to no rhythms ever. And I'm like, okay, obviously. So he refers to my people as the Fused. So with this conversation with Odium, Odium says, okay, why do you call him your friend? And L says, could you not think of a time when a friend needs to die? And Teravangian laughs. Rest in peace, Dalinar, probably. But Teravangian says, do you not want to give your friends another chance? And El says, no, when my friends were given the chance, they enslaved my, or entrapped my people or something like that. Clearly either referring to the Singers or the Fused or both. So I assume he's a Fused. I'm fairly certain he's a Fused. But he speaks to no rhythms. Why? Does he have no connection to Roshar? And why not?
Something's up with this guy.
Is he like a pre-Roshar Fused? Is he tethered to somewhere else that doesn't have rhythms? That's where my brain went.
Or did he simply have his like connection broken at some point?
Oh, yeah, like on purpose?
Right.
Yeah. Interesting.
But it's almost implied that, I don't think it says this, but it's kind of couched as maybe he's never had rhythms.
Right.
He's like, oh, rhythms, I don't do rhythms. Just like he doesn't do titles, apparently.
Two big things. Actually, one small thing and one big thing. He asks Odium if he has access to Else Callers, or corrupted Else Callers, or else otherwise accessing Else Gates. Elliot, you have a bunch of question marks on Else Gates.
Well,
go ahead.
Not only do they talk about Else Gates, that question is in the same breath as talking about Dai-Gnarthus.
Yeah, that's the big thing. We'll talk about that in a second.
Yeah. So my question is Dai-Gnarthus. So lead us into that, and then I'll ask my question.
Okay, so Dai-Gnarthus, the Black Fisher. I'm scared to Google this right now because it'll give me Wind and Truth spoilers. but yes, as far as my memory serves, Dai-Gnarthus, the Black Fisher, the one that we've theorized has been the one consuming emotion, right?
Yes.
I'm not conflating two.
You were theorizing that it's on Moash. Moash has the Black Fisher.
One of our two missing ones, correct?
Yes.
Like two episodes, three episodes ago, we plotted everybody in Dai-Gnarthus and the Dust Mother. I don't remember. So those are our two missing. Dai-Gnarthus is one of them. Black Fisher, consumer of emotion. Okay. That's pretty much all we know, and we need access to go through the Hornier perpendicularity to pick up the garrison there to go to the Shattered Plains. I listened to that and I was like, okay, hold on. I need a little spreadsheet here of where we're picking up Dai-Gnarthus to go to the peaks to pick up the garrison because we don't need the garrison at the peaks anymore. To then go fight at the Shattered Plains. Is that what you guys picked up?
Yeah, more or less.
Kind of.
It's quite a bit going on.
It's also implied that like Dai-Gnarthus is something that you can only unleash at a steep cost.
Right.
That comes up a couple of times. Are you willing to pay the cost of Diagon Arthas? What is that about?
Maybe she likes money.
Literal
dollars. Maybe you got to pay her.
I'm worried about the peaks. Horn Eater peaks. That does not sound pretty.
Well, but I actually came out of it with the other direction. I'm now wondering if we're underestimating the peaks and if the peaks are now going to be fine if we're pulling the garrison away from the peaks. That's where my brain went. But maybe you're right. Maybe they're already destroyed and the Horn Eaters have already left.
That's where I went with it. But then this whole back to the Elsgates thing is like, you're going to need an Elsgate. Okay. And you can only get that if you've got corrupted Elscholars or an Honor Blade. And then Odium's like, I have neither. I have Diagon Arthas. Oh. Okay. Can Diagon Arthas create an Elsgate?
Great question. I was spoiled on Elsgates from the Stormlight RPG. The Stormlight RPG defined Elsgates as like little portals that Elscholars can use to jump between Shadesmar and the physical realm, which you can, you know, conclude pretty quickly.
Yeah, that doesn't take a lot of guessing to arrive at that. We know what an Oathgate is. We know that Elscholars can do these little pop back and forth tricks. Is Elsgate just that? Like, you want to travel in and out of Shadesmar not at an Oathgate? You need an Elsgate.
Right.
So.
Yeah, just a lot of questions.
So, assumedly, what's happening here then is El takes Diagon Arthas, goes into Shadesmar, gets an army, heads to the Shattered Plains, uses an Elsgate to come through back to the physical realm and then assault the army at the Shattered Plains that way?
Yeah, that's what I assumed. And I also concluded that Sigzil is in big trouble. Sigzil is in big trouble. I don't think Sigzil wins the Zellian versus El fight, I'll be honest. Sunlit Man spoilers.
I would agree. I would agree with that. All right. Do we get to talk about Odium?
Yes, Odium, the divided one. Go, Paul. The
divided one. Oh, this is so cool. I wrote in my live reaction was, oh well, Tervangian just said he thinks he can do good and save everybody, so we can all kind of pack it up. We don't have to. We were worried about the contest of champions, but. Sounds like we're all good, so we can pack it up. No, I'm excited and encouraged by him, you know, taking control. He confronts cultivation a little bit by like, this was intentional, wasn't it? That you would have me on this fluctuating intelligence and emotion levels where he can sort of sometimes rule over the power of Odium and sometimes feel the power of Odium, which is a really interesting dynamic, and it's really cool. And I really happen to love this. The divided one sentiment is so cool. And I keep thinking it's
going to pause. Can I pause there real quick? I just want to make fun of Elliot real quick, because last time the divided one came up, Paul and I were fanboying super hard over the divided one and how excited we were. Elliot was not super bought in, but he seems to be now. So
I'm won over now. The fact that this is becoming a recurring thing, I think, is convincing me of, I'm now intrigued by where this is going to go. We now have another option in the twisted web of theories we've all spelled out, which is, what if Odium stops himself?
Yeah. I mean, Odium's not going to stop himself. Well, I'll just say that. But what if Odium shows up to the contest as rational or emotional or whatever that side of that you want to talk about and tries to stop it? That
I've Yeah, I said this at one point in the past of I think Taravangian is going to come up with some solution. This is my prediction, is that he's going to come up with some solution and day nine is going to end and he's going to be like, I've got it. I know how to save us. And then he's going to wake up on day 10 and be fully emotion side and like ruthless, like completely at the will of the shard, the power of Odium. And it's just going to, all that's going to go out the window is my theory, but we'll see what happens. But either way, it's very intriguing. It's we talked about it, cultivation pulling the strings or not pulling the strings. It's pretty neat. And then he talks about some of the other shards on other planets
Yeah, I
and
want to talk
drops
about
an
this.
absolute bomb. I'll let
Oh,
you
yeah.
talk about it,
Oh,
Trevor.
yeah. Okay. Okay. So, by far, the most exciting part about this epigraph was had nothing to do with Roshar. And I am sure this is absolutely just a one-liner that we're not going to get any more for the rest of this book. And I'm very sad about it. But Taravangian, in his inner dialogue, looks at the other shards, and he specifically says he's rooted to Roshar, but he can still observe and plan against the other shards. He sees them all except for two. I was like, okay, one I expected because we haven't been told the last one for a super long time. Okay, what's the other one? And Odium says, Valor. Valor has hidden herself even from him. And I was like, what? Okay, out of all the shards, I'll be honest, out of all the shards that we know nothing about except the name, Valor has intrigued me the most because Valor is like such a cool trait to like just isolated. But if you play with the shard idea of isolating Valor and only Valor, you can get some really weird things going on with like you only have Valor, like only have preservation, for example. If you only have preservation, that really warps your idea of like life. But if you only have Valor, what does that do? And Brandon throws this in of like, we're gonna do this one next. We're gonna explore Valor next. I'm like, yes.
I happen to agree. I'm extremely excited, and I don't think it will be relevant here, like fully relevant here. But like, okay, let's look at back half, or I don't think it'll happen, but I think it's possible that something could happen. I was just curious, so I looked up the textbook definition, the Oxford Dictionary definition of valor, and it is great courage in the face of danger, especially in battle. So there's other ways you could point at valor, but it is great courage in the face of danger. So that does not necessarily mean wisdom in choosing battles. That means I
Right.
have courage and I'm not afraid to fight,
I'm
you
going to
know?
fight anything in my way. Yeah.
I am not afraid to fight anything. Does not matter the power or anything like that. So there's some interesting implications that could come with that. And it's I'm also interested in how is Valor hiding from Taravangian in some way. Really crazy theory that we don't have time to talk about and is not going to happen. But there's one other character that we've known of that Taravangian is not able to see well, and that's Renarin.
Oh,
Because
for
Renarin,
now.
like within his little web, right, within his diagram, he can't really pinpoint Renarin because Renarin can see into the future, which he's not really supposed to be able to do. Therefore, it's like a wild card, like it's unpredictable. Renarin's concern also, here we go. Renarin's thing has been largely a lack of courage. So, you know, put those together, maybe he'll embody valor in the back half. But there we go. That's my crazy theory.
I'd be hesitant to say Renarin has a lack of courage. I'd say Renarin has a lack of facilitating how to act on his feelings. Like he feels courage. He jumps into the arena to save Adolin. He just doesn't know how to realistically do that.
And you are right. I completely agree. I was even thinking about this earlier with our characters who are sucked into the spiritual realm. I was trying to think of what kind of development there is. And I think back to Renarin historically, going into situations of battle or fighting and completely freezing, locking up. But he had his moment, his big moment where he got over that, which was exactly what you're saying, when he jumps into the pit with his brother to do so. So I don't think he will actually become the Shard of Valor and such, but I'm throwing some crazy. I've got to make up for all the other crazy predictions I've been shooting down. So
I had a different thought when I read about Odium tallying off the different shards. And that was simply, I wonder if at least in this moment, there can't be a fourth shard on Roshar. Because if there was, he would have noticed it right here.
Correct. And the other shards specifically say all three shards on Roshar are a problem and they're going to leave him to it.
Right. So I think there's a bunch of different theories out there. Trevor, you've had a couple that relate to other shards being involved on Roshar. And I want to use this maybe as evidence to say, at least in this moment, there isn't a fourth shard on Roshar. Now, I don't think that definitively proves that a shard can't have popped in the form of Tien and then left, like kind of, you know, thing.
Sure. Like, especially with like, ever since we learned about Virtuosity, kind of just wandering around and doing whatever the heck, and Mercy jumping around and doing a bunch of different stuff. Like being present at a bunch of different shards' deaths is Mercy.
Right.
I've always wondered what if a shard has popped in and left at some point, you know, popped in, helped kill on or left, you know, that type of thing.
I don't think this moment disproves much. It might narrow our search a tad of telling us that at least Odium inventoried all the shards at one point in time and accounted for all but two.
What's that last one, Brandon?
Well, and that last one, he's not expecting to be able to inventory.
Right.
Whatever that other hidden shard is, like everybody just knows that one's hidden. So it's almost like you can kind of
mystery.
Write that one off. And, there's
a mystery shard.
One. Yeah.
Did you guys have any thoughts on all the other shards viewed all three Roshar shards as a problem? I read that and I was like, oh, interesting. But I didn't really have that much more thought on it. Up until this point, we've thought, okay, keep Odium in the Roshar genie bottle. But from Teravangian's perspective, it's, oh, keep all three of them in the Roshar genie bottle. We don't want to even help cultivation or honor.
This is very believable because we have notably not seen either honor or cultivation. We know honor was killed, and we know cultivation is got a touch on everything, but is very behind the scenes. And we talked about it. Can we trust cultivation? And I want to trust cultivation, but I don't think I should. And so I think it will come. I think maybe that's some things we might learn more in the spiritual realm. There's maybe a lot we've always thought of honor and cultivation are the good guys. Odium is the bad guy. That could be totally different.
And the Stormfather mentions like him and honor's embarrassment about the Oath Pact or something like that. So I'm actually beginning to be a little bit suspicious of Tanavast, personally.
I could definitely see the other shards not being huge fans of honor, because I'm guessing that honor in a lot of situations becomes pretty combative, in that honor doesn't compromise with anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. Honor goes, you just did something wrong. My honor compels me to stop you from doing that, you know, kind of that situation is going to come up a lot. So for them to want to be like, okay, honor, you go play in the corner and don't talk to anybody makes a lot of sense.
You take your high road over there. Yeah,
exactly. I could see all of them thinking that. The cultivation, though, is the wild card. And we've already learned maybe we can't trust cultivation. But like, why? What about growth is so problematic?
I can see how preservation wouldn't like cultivation.
Definitely.
But I don't know about the other ones. Isn't invention one of them? I think invention's one of them. Anyways.
It's either that or innovation or something like that. But I think you're right, actually. I think it's invention.
Nice extended episode of Following Know It On. Anything else, gentlemen?
I think we hit most of the things. Yeah.
I don't know.
And here we are, end of day two, making some serious progress into this massive, so large book it falls apart sitting on your shelf.
Indeed. I don't know if we've run this long since like Oathbringer's recordings.
Yeah, it's been a minute. I didn't even realize this one really got away from
yes, me. It did.
It feels like we've been talking for 20 minutes and just got started.
All right. I don't know next week's chapters because Tim hasn't sent them to me yet. So let's reconvene with whatever it is next week. Thanks for joining me, Elliot Paul.
See ya.
Toodles.